There we go again.
So Gene came there, and really, he's a real smart manager. I mean, a baseball man, smart. I mean, real smart. And I coached at third base for him that year. And he decided next year that he, that's a 54, he decided next year that he wanted to go back and play some. So he went back to the Red Sox and played some of the Red Sox 2 or 3 years, second base. And Earl Mann came to me after the, after the 53 season and asked me, says, would you like to manage? Well, I really didn't tell you the truth about it. I didn't know whether I could manage or not. But I needed the money. I says, I might say to myself, I might not have a job if I don't try. So I thought, well, I'll try it. And told him I took it. And Earl gave me $900 a month. And I think he told me, I'm not sure about this, that that's the most he ever gave anybody. And that if I had a good year the next year, I need not ask for any more. So we had a pretty good year. We won everything. We won the right to play the All-Star game in Atlanta. We won the All-Star game. In fact, I pitched in the All-Star game.
Really?
Dixie Walker told me and Nashville, after a game one night, was coming home. He says, I'm going to let you start the All-Star game. I thought that was the craziest thing I ever heard of in my life. And I started it.
You were only 46 years old.
Yeah. And hadn't pitched in several years.
Sounds like Jim Palmer this spring, doesn't it?
And I thought, well, I thought, you were crazy. But I did. I could throw. I got to put some batting practice in my arm. Came around. I threw pretty good. And I remember I got in trouble in the first inning. And the little outfield was leading the league, hitting about 380 something for Little Rock. So I knew, and I can't think of his name. My left-hand hitter came up with the bases full, two men out. And they had scored one run. And I looked like Dixie just going to have to take me out. We had about 16,000 people there that night, I think the biggest crowd that they ever had. And I remember... Kitchen went down and gave me a fastball sign, and I shook him off. And he came back with a curveball sign, and I threw him a curveball and struck him out. He took it. He didn't strike it. He took it right down to 3-2. And there's something about that, too, that I won't tell. And I struck him out and got out of that inning, and I pitched a third inning. And Dixie asked me in the fourth inning, says, you want any more? I said, yeah, let me pitch one more and dangle. And my brother was sitting in the stands that night with my family. And he said, yeah, the darn fool just like that. Said, he never gets enough. I got out of trouble, you know. And I went out there and got him out, so I pitched all right and got him out. And but he told me that afterward that I can throw pretty good.
Well, next year you were teaching people in Philadelphia how to throw.
Yeah. Well, the reason for that was that I missed a pension plan 1 year. 1 year. If I'd have been there in 46, I'd have been in Major League in 46, I'd have been in the pension plan. But I missed 16 and a half years of my playing time, see. And I kept... Back in my head, I like to get in that thing. Good, you had to go back and stay 5 years. Now, three coaches can participate in the pension plan just like a ball player can. But he had to be there 5 years to do it. So after the Mayo Smith managed the Birmingham club that year, and he saw we had a pretty good year. And the general manager, Roy Hamme, called me and says, would you like to come up to Philadelphia next year as our pitching coach? And I finally talked to him about it and finally agreed on salary. I think they agreed to pay me $12,000 a year. And I said, well, what kind of a contract will you give me? How long? And he says, well, how about 3 years? And that was great. I thought, well, if I get 3 years, then I can certainly get 2 years somewhere else, even if I not, don't get it there. And I took it up, and I went there and helped. I think I helped a lot, a good many pitchers.
I know that Jack Sanford pitched real well.
I helped Jack Sanford a lot. In fact, you don't help all pitchers. They had some good arms that year, and some of them you're always disappointed when you don't help them, and I understand that now. You just don't help everybody. They can't do what you tell them to do. Now, I was started to changing the speed of the ball. That made me a pitcher, but you know what? I actually learned that myself. I didn't have anybody tell me that.
Was there a pitching coach on the team when you learned that?
No. Well, there was with Detroit, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't tell you much.
Was there anybody in particular on that Phillies team that could have been a great pitcher if they could have actually done what you were telling them to do? Who had the natural ability?
Well,
but not the.
Of course, Roberts was there, and
right.
and what's a left-hand pitcher? What's his name?
The left-hand pitcher.
Left-hand pitcher on the club that year.
Oh.
Went to St. Louis.
Was Turk Farrell left-handed?
No.
Fellow named Jack Meyer on that club, too.
Yeah, Jack Meyer. He had a good arm. Yeah, he had a real good arm. He ought to have been a better pitcher than he was, really, because he had good enough stuff. Sanford, Meyer, Roberts, and that left end.
Were you able to help Roberts at all? Did you try to do anything with Robin Roberts?
Well, there wasn't much you could do. He's a good pitcher. I've got that record. It's a book here that somebody gave me. It's got all those names in it.
Well, this doesn't have all the names in it, but we're looking at 57. Robin Roberts, is that the year we're looking at, 1957? Or 55 through 57. We had pitchers like Robin Roberts, Murray Dixon. Not familiar with this name. Harry Wehmeyer. Kurt Simmons. Is that the one?
Good God. I think I have Kurt something too. But he found one in St. Louis, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed in St. Louis over several years. He just started changing the speed of the ball and helped him a lot too. Yeah.
I remember him as a pitcher. Now Harvey Haddix was on the team too. There's another good lefty.
Harvey Haddix. Had good stuff. He should have. Well, he did write good.
Well, he certainly did real well for 12, 13 innings against Milwaukee in 1958, didn't he?
Sure did.
You'll see Don Cardwell. He was a righty, wasn't he?
Yeah. He had a good arm. They had some good arms.
Jim Hearn, he lives in Atlanta, doesn't he?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was up there that year.
Did you have a chance to do any managing after while you were a coach? Did you get any offers to do any managing?
No, I didn't. We never did finish that story. I got those 3 years in, see, with the Philadelphia club, and I think Roy Hamey called me and on Thursday. And says, which says we are not going to renew your contract for next year. And I didn't ask him why or anything, because to tell you, to be frank with you, I didn't want to go back to Philadelphia. And in fact, if it hadn't been for Walter Moses over there, I don't think I'd ever stayed in Philadelphia, because he and I were real good friends. And I probably stayed there because, you know, he's from Georgia, too.
Right.
What's the little place down south?
Vidalia? Yeah, he died just this past year.
Yeah,
I think it was in Vidalia where he
I bought hams from a fellow down there, a fellow by the name of Morris, and he knew Wally. And Wally came down there, and they put him, he and his wife, in a home together. And they stayed in the home, and every time I'd call Mr. Morris up, he'd tell me something about how Wally was doing. And he finally called me and told me he died. Yeah, he's great. He said, boy, he was a good hitter.
Yeah,
he
great
could, he could run like a deer. But anyway, agreed. I told him, that's what my reason for going back as a coach and not Earl Mann tried his best to get me to come back as a manager. And I don't know whether I made a mistake or not. I don't know. I may have. I don't know. Now I would say I didn't. But
Jim Greengrass said you would have made a great manager.
Yeah. He was good. He was a pretty good ball player. He had some good ball players.
Yes.
What's his name? The Jones who played third base?
Puddinhead?
What's the shortstop's name?
Hamner. Granny Hamner.
He had some good ball players.
When you went over to...
Who was a big first baseman?
On the Phillies?
Who?
On the Phillies, you mean? Big first baseman on the Phillies?
Don't sound right.
No, you're asking who was the first baseman on the Phillies about that time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're right-handed. Lopez. No, not Lopez.
Well, pitcher. No, I'm thinking the only name I came up with is Marv Blaylock as the first baseman of the Phillies. I don't know.
Stan Lopata.
Was he a
catcher, but he played.
Yeah, okay, I think of him as a catcher.
Yeah, but he played first base. Huh? And, the outfielder was a good hitter.
Richie Ashburn?
Well, Ashburn was good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I like Ashburn. He and I were good friends.
Maybe
too.
The best defensive center fielder the National League.
I'm
ever
talking
had.
About that, the left fielder. Good hitter.
Del Ennis?
They rode him, though. It was unmerciful that to be the tight ball player he was, and they rode the heck out of him.
The fans?
He lived there, you know.
Oh.
His daddy lived there, and he worked for, the hat, famous hat place.
Stetson?
Huh?
The Stetson
hat place, yeah. Actually, went down there, we had a carload of hats.
And the fans were real hard on that.
Oh,
Delmas.
They were all hard. That was pathetic. Because he wasn't a great fielder, but boy, I'll tell you one thing. He was a good hitter.
He could hit some balls nobody else could.
They'd get
field.
On him because he didn't, you know, didn't come catch balls out. He'd have a ball hit right in his hand. He'd drop it. But he said he wouldn't renew my contract, and I got 3 years in, see. And after I hung up the phone talking, I said to myself, now what in the thunder mind? What am I going to do? I said, I'm out of a job. My son's out of a job now. But Eastern Airline, I was telling him about it. He's a pilot for 25 years, captain, and doesn't have a job. He doesn't have the pension. They even got the money tied up in his pension.
I know.
And I know how he feels. And I said, what in the world am I going to do? It looked like the good Lord is already on us. I really said sincerely about this. The good Lord has always come along, and he's always taken care of me. I tore my knee up. I got all right. I had my arm operated on. Took 13 chips out of my arm, couldn't even move it. It's just like that. Come back through after that. Always said the good Lord always come around and hit me many times in life. But he did this time. Like I said, after that, I said, what in the world am I going to do? On Saturday, a man called me by the phone And says, Whit says, I see you're not going back to Philadelphia. It says, would you like to join our club? And I want to tell you, I didn't even know who I was talking to. And I says, yes. I didn't care where it was. And he finally says, this is John Quinn, the general manager of the Braves. So I could have fell over. That's 1928 now. And they had won the pennant.
Oh, 58, yeah.
58. 50, I'm sorry. They had won the pennant and beat the Yankees in the World Series. Who makes a change then? You don't make changes. And I couldn't believe it. He wanted me as a pitching coach. And there's some fellow from Georgia was a pitching coach. But anyway, I didn't understand it, but I didn't argue with him about it. And I said, he evidently thought a lot of me because I tell you, it wasn't hard for me to make a deal with him. I says, he asked me what about the contract, and I was getting $12,000 at Philadelphia. And he says, tell you what, Deuce, we'll give you $18,000. Just like that.
Big jump.
And that's what I got, most I got when I won 22 games. I had to hold out all the spring training to get $18,000. And I said, okay. I said, well, how about the length of the contract? He says, well, whatever you think, what do you want? And just something popped in my head. And I says, how about 3 years? He says, that's fine.
Well, that puts you over the 5 years for sure.
So,
right.
So I had my, if I did well enough, he didn't send me home, I had but of course, I stayed there I stayed there 9 years. In other words, I got 13 years in as a coach, and that was my pension. And I think my pension, I got about all right. I did fine. I mean, like I said, the good Lord always taking care of me. And I had this farm, and I had 1,400 acres here together, and I fiddled around, I made more money out of real estate than I have anything else. And
good pitchers when you came along. What did you say to somebody like Warren Spahn when you were his pitching coach?
I let him talk to me. Spahn and Burdett. Now you talk about two cutters. Now there's two cutters. But he was probably the greatest pitcher I ever saw. Spahn was. I mean, I'm talking about from a pitching standpoint. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about a fellow with stuff now. You know, he was in the service about three years.
Yeah.
And
didn't win his first game until he was 25.
When he got on that mound, he really knew how to pitch.
Well, I was thinking about how mean you were, and you probably know the story. Casey Stengel got mad at Spahn back in the 40s for not being mean enough. I don't know, did you ever hear that story?
No. Said he wasn't mean enough.
Right, it was back when Casey was coaching or managing the Boston Braves.
I don't remember being that mean, but he was a competitor.
Well, Stengel told Spahn to throw inside to somebody.
Yeah.
And Spahn did, but not close enough to suit Stengel. And Stengel went and just yanked him out of the game immediately and said, "You haven't got any guts at all." And next thing Casey knew about it, Spahn had been in World War II, Purple Heart, and a couple Silver Stars.
Yeah.
So it showed it was a little bit different.
He was, I tell you, he was a competitor to every was one. And had the best control of a screwball that I ever saw anybody throw. Boy, he could take that right here, that plate, that corner right there, and he could hit that corner just like that right there. All day. Right hand hitter. He made them look bad.
Well, you saw Carl Hubble pitch too, didn't you? Was he still pitching when you came up to the Dodgers?
Yeah.
Can you compare Spahn and Hubble?
Uh, really, I tell you, he didn't pitch. I didn't see him pitch that much. Uh-huh. I couldn't say.
He was kind of the end of his career, I guess,
by that
time.
Yeah.
Well, if you don't mind, let me go back over a couple of things, because I've got a couple of questions and a couple of things I'd like to clear up if I could. When you said that Babe Ruth hit that home run off you, what year was that that you were talking about? Was that 29, your first year up?
I think it was in 30.
Okay. Yeah, I was curious about that.
Was that his last year?
34 was his last year.
Huh?
34 was his last year in the American League, and then he went over to the
Philadelphia.
Boston Braves.
No, Boston Braves.
In 35.
Yeah.
Did you, let's see. A couple people wanted me to ask some questions of you. Did you pitch against the A's when you were in the American League?
Did I pitch against who, the A's?
The A's, right. Do you have any particular stories or memories about the A's? And Connie Mack, Mr. Mack in particular.
No, let's see. Yeah, I pitched against Philadelphia. Simmons, Dax, and...
probably a fellow named
Hoss. Hoss, what do you pronounce it? And well, I don't remember too much of it. But when I joined the White Sox, see, now they had made a trade for Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Hoss and Simmons and Dax.
They were all over there.
They were all over there, mm-hmm. See.
Were pitchers throwing spitballs still in the 30s when you were there, or was that something that was history?
It seemed like it's two or three grams.
You still around then, huh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And was Red Faber still pitching there?
Red Faber, right. Yeah, he was on the club that year, yeah.
There's a story that I've been asked to ask you about, and so I will. Has to do with Paul Wehner. Let me see if I can pull this out here. There are two versions of the story, and this gentleman is wanting to know which one is correct. Paul Wehner was with the Braves, and you were pitching for Brooklyn. You had a two-run lead in the fourth inning and nobody on, and so you decided to experiment. You started throwing Paul Wehner fastballs inside to find out if he still had the power to pull it over the fence, so the story goes. And if Wehner did do that, you'd still be ahead because you had this two-run lead, nobody was on, and you'd know what not to throw to Wehner in the clutch, you know, if the game were on the line. According to this version of the story, Wehner was thinking right along with you. He backed away and deliberately fouled your inside fastball, and that gave you the idea that you were too fast.
I don't believe anybody deliberately.
Okay.
I don't believe anybody deliberately fouled the ball. He might have fouled it, but he didn't deliberately do it.
Okay.
I don't believe that.
Okay. Well, let me continue with this. That's very interesting to hear. It says Wehner was setting a trap for you for the moment when he could unload on that on an inside pitch.
And
then, yes, sir?
Well, it brings up another on that line.
Okay.
About it's three pitchers. I say if a pitcher's in the major league today can do. If you can pitch to a good hitter, I'm talking about good hitters now. I'm not you. What you overpower your weak hitters and throw your shit stuff to the good hitters.
Good.
That's the expression. 2-0, 3-1, and 3-2. If you can throw something over the plate, and I really don't, you can spot pitch them if you got that kind of control. But if you can throw a strike at those times in the major leagues today, you can win in the major leagues. 2-0, 3-1, 3-2. And I won't tell you anything. What you get there. Rocha relieved me with me in the Polo Grounds against the Giants, and we were leading, I forget what the dang score was, but this must have been 40. What was his last year playing?
A Durocher? I'm gonna guess about 38. Let me find out for sure.
Must have been, because.
Well, he played two games in 1945.
That wouldn't have been it. It must have been 38. He was managing.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd called me in from the bullpen with the bases full, two men out, and 3-2 on the hitter. So that's just not
that. That's a pressure situation.
And the reason I know is that he was still playing shortstop. Because I had to walk by him come in from the bullpen. And he walks all the way from the shortstop into the mound. And on the way in, he says, "What are you going to throw him?" You know who the hitter was? Mellott. I didn't have any more idea than a man in the moon what I was going to throw him. And I thought he was a dang fool for asking me what I was going to throw him in the first place, because I knew whatever I threw and he hit, he'd second guess me. So I didn't say anything. And I won't tell you what I did. The right-hand catcher on our club side going. I don't know how come him to catch that day, but anyway, he caught. And I made, you're allowed 7 pitches, warm-up pitches, when you come into a game. I threw 7 slow curves. I didn't throw a fastball at all. And Ott was sitting over there on his knee with that bat in his hand, and I knew what kind of hitter he was, and he's the kind of hitter I'm talking about. And I said to myself, he's guessing with me, and I'm guessing with him. And I says, "By gosh, I know what he's going to look for. He knows I'm a pretty good pitcher. He gave me credit for being a pretty good pitcher." Of course, all this goes through the head. And he knows, he saw me throwing those slow curves. And he knows I'm not going to throw him a fastball. So I hope when the catcher goes down, he manages the Cubs 1 or 2 years. You know, with that...
I'll have to work on that.
And I says, I hope he calls for a curveball. In fact, he thought that's what I wanted to throw because I had thrown all slow curves. Didn't throw a fastball at all with my 7 pitches. And he thought that's what I wanted to throw. And it just like that. And I said, "By gosh, I'm going to throw him a fastball," which ordinarily was 99 times out of 100 the worst pitch you could have thrown. And I knew that. But he was guessing with me, and he knew that's what he was going to get. And when I threw him the fastball, I took a nice, easy windup, like I was going to throw, just like, you know, I was going to throw something easy. And all at once I came through and I threw him a fastball. I threw that ball straight down the middle. By gosh, you can throw it right there just like that. Just about that high. And he stood there and took it.
Got him flat-footed.
I went to the bench and DeRocher got on me. He says, "If you ever get a hitter like that in a spot like that," says, "don't you ever throw him the fastball."
But he didn't mind that you struck him out, did he?
So he won the ball game, and I managed the year 54, and Ott lives in New Orleans, and we were playing down there that day. And he come in the clubhouse, and I'd made a move, Dave, with my pitchers, and didn't pitch a McMahon, who was my best relief pitcher. I didn't pitch him, I let somebody else pitch. It was with the Philadelphia club, a right-hander. And he had pitched a great game in Mobile, so I let him come in. And I knew, I was trying to give Don a little extra rest, you know, a day's rest. He would pitch the heck out of him. And they beat us that ball game. And after the game was over, I was in the clubhouse, and dang, I was sick because I knew that was me. I managed, and I lost that ball game myself, and they were battling us for the dang pennant. And I was sitting there grieving about it, and somebody patted me on the shoulder, and I looked around, and that's who it was. It was Mel Ott. And he sat down and talked to me, and I told him what I had done. And he says, well, I'll never forget one pitch. And all that time, he remembered that pitch. He said, you would have bet $1 million to a dime that I wouldn't ever throw him a fastball at that time. And ordinarily, I wouldn't.
Right.
But that's just part of pitching. I don't know why you do some things sometimes, but you do them. It's the wrong pitcher, but it was the right one.
Would you remember this game against Wehner when he was with the Braves? Does that ring a bell at all? According to Ty Cobb, eighth inning, two on and nobody out, and a home run would win the game. And Wehner's up there. Anyway, he hit a sacrifice bunt to advance the runners.
I don't remember that game.
There's another one where he did hit the inside fast one for a home run. Do you remember Paul Wehner beating you with a home run?
No, I don't, but I know one thing. He was that type of player. I mean, he could hit a fastball. He was great. In fact, he was on our club year.
That's right.
He was on our club.
Go
ahead.
So how many springs did the Dodgers go to Havana for spring training?
Only one.
Only one? 1942?
Yeah, 42.
Do you have any stories about that spring training?
Well, I stayed at home. I held out. In fact, I had to hold out all of spring training till they came back to Florida. And I joined them down in Florida. And I wanted to talk to McPhail about my contract. And we talked a while, and he finally says, you write down on a slip of paper what you think you ought to get, and I'm going to write down on a slip of paper what I think I could give you. And we'll just exchange them. Well, I was going to ask for $18,000. That's what I asked for. And he put $16,000 down on his. And I asked for $18,000. And he said, after he looked at it, he says, well, I tell you, he says, you're a great fella to have on a ball club, and I really appreciated that too, you know. And Branch Rickett said the same thing about me. And he says, you're a great fella to have on a club to begin with, and he says, I think you deserve it, says, I'm going to give you $18,000. So that's the reason I got $18,000. That wasn't a heck of a lot of money, but then it was just good money.
Yes, it was. Well, you probably you missed out on some high times in Havana then, I guess, in 1942. I guess that was quite a spring training.
Yeah.
I've certainly heard some stories about that.
About Casey.
And Ernest Hemingway in particular.
I
guess that they had a friendship that carried on over the next several years. Is that right? Did they become good
they
friends?
They must have, yeah. That Casey was a...
And he was from Atlanta. Isn't that right?
Yeah, he's mean. He's tough on that man now. He just didn't hit you between the eyes or not. It wouldn't make any difference to him. And we were good. We were real good friends, Casey and his wife. And we went up to Upper New York, out of New York City a lot of times to a place up there and played golf on off days and stayed up there over the week whenever we had off days and played golf in the country club up there. And I knew them real well, and I knew her. And I guess you knew this, that when he came, you knew what happened to him?
Yes. Well, I know that he committed suicide. I don't know any.
He was talking to his wife at the Ansley Hotel over the phone. I don't know what was her name. I knew him real well. We ran with him a good bit. And she talked to him, and finally he says, I'm gonna commit suicide. And he had this gun, he had it propped up under his shin, and killed himself. And of all the people in the world that you thought would have committed suicide, I wouldn't have ever thought Casey, that type of would have ever committed suicide. It was something. I think he had a little trouble financially now.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, I think he.
Was he a pretty good drinker, too?
Yeah, he drank pretty good, yeah.
Well, you know, Hemingway killed himself in a very similar manner about 10 years
ago. Is that
later.
Right? Yeah. Well, if he run the case, he must have drank.
Yes, I'll bet.
Well, now, you know what, I say that, and I say we're pretty good friends, but you know what, that's something I never did do much. I never did smoke, never smoked, and I never drank very little. I've had drinks. In fact, I drink maybe drink a bottle of beer now, in the afternoon, one bottle. I told my doctor here not long ago, I asked him about it. He says two bottles of beer would probably help you. It does. It gives you a little lift. And he says, but if you get to drinking more than two bottles of beer a day, then you might hurt yourself. And Casey, the more he drank, the harder stuff.
That's one of the reasons you've made it to 83, I suspect.
Gosh, don't tell.
There were.
But he sure was. He was a good-hearted fellow.
There was another person who had a reputation for being a good drinker too on that team, Kirby Higbee.
Oh. Yeah. Right.
I've been meaning to read his autobiography. That's on my list of things to do. The High Hard One. I've been wanting to read that and haven't gotten around to it yet. Have you read it?
Uh-huh. Is a book that he wrote?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I guess
it is. Well, you know, he won 22 games that year.
Right.
He won 22 and lost 9. I won 22 and lost 10.
That's the start of a real good pitching staff.
But Kirby, he couldn't. Worst thing about him, he'd get out in front and he'd get beat.
He'd let up.
I was just the opposite.
And Stan Musial said that when you pitched against Mort Cooper, the first person who got a run behind him would be the one who'd win. I guess there were a lot of 1-0, 2-0 games between you and Mort Cooper.
Oh, yeah.
I guess those were the great.
Look, like every time I pitched against him, I had to pitch against Cooper. I don't know why.
I guess those were the greatest pitching duels of the early 40s, when you and Cooper would match up.
I see.
Well, let me ask you about some of the players that you played with. And I guess one of the things I'm hoping to get out of you, or is that there's a particularly interesting story that tells me a little bit more about Charlie Gehringer, for example, or a particularly funny story. Well, let's start with that. What's the funniest story that you remember from all of your years of pitching? What's the funniest thing you ever saw on a ball field?
Oh,
or was there anything?
I'd have to think. I don't know what. But what you mentioned, Gehringer.
Sure. Can you tell me any stories about Charlie Gehringer from your years on the club with him?
Only story I can tell you about Charlie Gehringer, he's just great. Great hitter, great fielder, great fellow to have on the club. High class fella. I mean, he was really. In fact, I don't believe he could have been beat. Now, I say really Billy Herman is probably the smartest ball player I ever saw, but Gehringer is the greatest second baseman I ever saw.
Who was the best first baseman you ever saw? Let's talk about some of that. Who was the greatest first baseman you saw in all those years?
Fielding-wise.
I guess I'm going to ask you for your all-star team.
Camilli was the best fielder I ever saw. I wouldn't necessarily compare him to some of the other hitters. He was a great hitter, but he was strictly a low ball hitter. In other words, he could be pitched to pretty good if you pitch up. But if you get, boy, you get pitching low to him, he'd ruin you. That doesn't mean now that he couldn't hit a fastball at all up here. That means that
his weakness
if he had a weakness, it was He was a high fastball.
But he was the slickest fielding first baseman you saw, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
And on second,
by Garinger, far.
And on second, you choose Charlie Garinger. You choose Charlie Garinger for your second baseman,
gosh,
then, right?
Yeah, yeah.
What about shortstop?
I saw some and I thought they all good.
Well, I know you played with Pee Wee Reese and you played with Luke Appling.
Appling was great then. Darn his hitter I ever saw. He could hit the ball on right field better than anybody I ever saw. A right hand hitter. Dang, he'll wear that right field out. We were real close too, after that.
Who are you? I'm sorry.
He and his wife. They're a fine couple. Let's see. It'd be hard at Marin was a real good shortstop. Like he was on that club I was telling you about, I pitched that 1-0 game. And Reese
wasn't bad either, was he?
I mean, it'd be kind of hard, would it?
What about around third base?
Name some, I can't think of.
Oh, gee, Marv Owen, Jimmy Dykes, Ricky Lavagetto, pardon?
Dykes? Yeah, third baseman.
Yeah.
Lavagetto was a good ball player, too.
And you played with some good outfielders, too. Al Simmons, Terry Heilman, Earl Averill, of course, on the Brooklyn team, Dixie Walker, Joe Medwick, Pete Reeser, Augie Galen, Paul Wehner was there for a while. He was towards the end of his career.
Yeah. Did you ever hear anything about Paul drinking?
I've heard it, yeah. Are those stories true?
I don't know that as far as being on the Brooklyn Club with him, but I've heard that he drank, drank a good. In fact, I heard the story one time that about him signing up. He and the general manager got together on some kind of a contract where he wouldn't drink. And you got to have a bad year, he just go ahead and drink. And said he carried out on the bench and drank with him out, get behind the water cooler and take a drink. No, I don't know that's true.
Well, it didn't seem to hurt him too much anyway.
No, he's a great hitter.
What about catchers? Who was the best catcher that you were, did you have a particular catcher that you wanted to have behind the plate when you were pitching?
Well, the catcher that hit me the most.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'd have to say that Mancuso would probably was the smartest catcher that I ever pitched to.
In other words, he was helping you read the hitters?
Right, right. And one good catcher. I mean, good catcher.
I beg your pardon?
Owen. But he wasn't that type of catcher. Let's see who else. Name some of the catchers. I can't think of a lot.
Well, with Detroit, there was Ray Hayward got with them.
Ray Hayward was one of the best friends I ever had in my life. We were real close. In fact, he came to the Brooklyn Club, you know.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
Oh, he was a scout. Not playing, but a scout. And he was smart. And he lived at High Point, North Carolina. And he'd come down there. I'd go up there and go hunt with him. He was a friend of mine from Cedartown. Got to hunt with him. And we went on several hunt trips together. In Virginia, his wife, she's a fine person.
when you went to the White Sox, the catcher was Luke Sewell. Another pretty good player.
Yeah, good catcher.
And then with Cleveland, that one year that you were there, a player I don't know anything about. Maybe you can help me with this. Frankie Pitlack?
Pitlack.
Pitlack.
Yeah.
Can you tell me anything about it? I don't know that name at all, but I know he was a catcher on the Cleveland Club
that
year.
He was a good catcher, but I can't say that he was the best catcher. I wouldn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
He's a good catcher.
And then, of course, it was Mickey Owen in Brooklyn. He was the catcher those years.
Mm-hmm.
And then Andy Semenik with the Phillies.
Yeah. And he's a pretty good catcher, too. He's a smart catcher now.
Mm-hmm.
He'd probably help you. You know, I'm talking about being smart now. As far as calling pitches, that's what I'm talking about, calling pitches. He seemed to do more thinking. And he was over at Philadelphia while he was there.
That's right. Right.
Yeah.
What was the best defense?
He looked like he ought to have been made a good manager.
I thought that, too. I suspect he did some coaching. I think he did.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Huh? I did, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What was the best defensive play that you ever saw?
The best what?
Defensive play.
Play?
Yes, sir.